Okay, so I guess we can start. So just to remind you very briefly what we are trying to do here, the purpose of these particular sutras that I'm reading out now. The idea behind this is to show the, at the beginning, showing the connection between morality and virtue and the practice of meditation. And all the sutras I'm looking at now is basically how to purify yourself, how to improve your morality, purify your mind, so that actually you're able to succeed better in the meditation practice. This is what this is about. And even the sutras that I'm reading out now, this is going to be more on contemplation of various aspects of life, in particular the death contemplation and also other things. Even these things, the purpose of these things is to purify yourself. So when you, sometimes when people think death contemplation, they think, oh, this is depressing, but the purpose is actually to purify yourself and to make yourself feel at ease and feel good about things rather than feel depressed or sad or whatever. Okay, so the first sutta today is one reason I'm going to read this sutta out is because I remember when I first read the sutta, it made a really strong impact on me. It's a very simple sutta, and sometimes the simple suttas are the ones that to me make a lot of impact. And I remember reading this one, I thought, wow, this is interesting here. So anyway, see what, you may not like it at all, but anyway, this is just my preference. So this is called the Araka Sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya. Bhikkhus, in the past there was a teacher named Araka, the founder of a spiritual sect, one without lust for sensual pleasures. The teacher Araka had many hundreds of disciples to whom he taught such a Dhamma as this. Brahmins, short is the life of human beings, limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. So that is the, I'll just explain to you here what's going on. So a teacher named Araka, this idea that, and this is a long time in the past, so there's always been teachers around, always been spiritual guides around in all society, I suppose, all societies, and he was one of these, and he was a founder of a spiritual sect. In other words, a leader of a spiritual tradition, right? And he was one without lust for sensual pleasures. That is a short time to say that he had good meditation, right? He was beyond sensual pleasures. He had a samadhi, perhaps the jhanas and that sort of thing. That's what that means. But presumably he didn't have anything beyond that. He didn't have the deep insights that we are trying to achieve in the Buddhist practice. Still, this is pretty, it's very, a lot of respect to people who have deep meditation like that, because that is already very, gone a long, long way and far beyond what the vast majority of people ever get in their spiritual practice. And he had many hundreds of disciples, and he taught life such as this, Brahmins. Brahmins here presumably just means it's a term of honor for people who are practicing the spiritual path. It doesn't mean that they necessarily were Brahmins as such, just an honorific saying, you noble people, basically. Short is the life of human beings, right? Limited and fleeting. It has much suffering and much misery. Okay? So, useful teaching method. Obviously, this is about death contemplation, right? Short is the life of human being. Remembering how short life is. And this is a very useful thing to do, to remember how fast it all goes by. I often think about my own life. I'm approaching 50 now, and I often think, what happened to it all? It's all disappeared. I think I've used my life reasonably well, but still, it seems to have gone so fast. It was only yesterday I was 20, or even in my teens or whatever, and suddenly you find yourself being almost 50. It's remarkable how fast things tend to pass and go away. So one should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome, lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. And this is really the important point here. The important point is that if you contemplate death, if you contemplate how short life is, it leads you to want to practice the spiritual life. It leads you to do what to do, to want to do what is good. That is a not natural consequence of understanding that life is short, that life is fleeting, that it can come to an end virtually at any time. That's what it does. So the correct contemplation of death propels you forward on the path. It makes you practice in the right way. So for this reason, it can be a very useful contemplation to do. And this particular one, when he's young, the younger you are, the more easy it is to forget about death, right? It seems so far away. But is it really that far away? And this is really the sort of thinking which brings you forward on the in the practice. So then comes some beautiful similes about how short life actually is. These are the similes that were used by this teacher called Araka to bring out the shortness of life, right? Just as a drop of dew on the tip of a blade of grass will vanish quickly at sunrise and will not last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a drop of dew. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. So life is like the dew on the tip of a blade of grass that vanishes quickly at sunrise, right? That's pretty, that's quite a powerful way of putting it. And then, just as when thick drops of rain are pouring down, a water bubble will quickly vanish and will not last long. So too, Brahmin, human life is like a water bubble. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Just as a line drawn on water with a stick will quickly vanish and will not last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a line drawn on water with a stick. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Just as a river flowing down from a mountain, going a long distance with a swift current, carrying along much flotsam, will not stand still for a moment, an instant, a second, but will rush on, swirl and flow forward. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a mountain stream. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Right? That is quite a vivid simile there. People are like this mountain stream which is rushing along, right? Most people rush along in their life from one thing to another, doing this, doing that, never really stopping, never reflecting, never having a perspective on their life, on their existence, always being caught up in things all the time, like this mad river rushing along. And then when you try to stop and you try to actually be peaceful, you realize that the momentum of life, the thing that carries you forward, is so strong, it's hard to stop, right? You come to Dharma Grove, you come for a weekend retreat or a 9-day retreat, and you can see how your mind is kind of conditioned into thinking very fast, and your whole kind of momentum is so strong. It's difficult to stop, and you can't do that. It's like you get caught up in things. And what are you moving towards? And of course, what you're moving towards is always your death, right? You're rushing along to do all this stuff that seems so important in life. And where do you end up? You end up dying anyway. So that's kind of... it's not really sad. It's just, it makes you change your priorities around, right? When you realize that, wait a minute, what am I doing this for? Does it really matter here? Okay. I really like the next one here. The next one here is quite graphic. Just as a strong man might form a lump of spittle at the tip of his tongue and spit it out without difficulty, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a lump of spittle. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Just as a piece of meat thrown into an iron pan, heated all day, will quickly vanish and will not last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like this piece of meat. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Just as when a cow to be slaughtered is being led to the slaughterhouse. Whatever leg she lifts, she is close to slaughter, close to death. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a cow doomed to slaughter. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. You're like a cow led to the slaughterhouse, right? Always moving towards the end. That particular simile is also found in Ajahn Brahm's book, The Art of Disappearing, is also in there. So it's a recollection, again, a very nice recollection about death. And then comes the kind of the crucial point here. But at that time, because the human lifespan was 60,000 years, and girls were marriageable at the age of 500. At that time, people had only six afflictions: cold, heat, hunger, thirst, excrement, and urine. Though people had such a long lifespan and lived so long, and though their afflictions were so few, still, the teacher Araka gave his disciples a teaching such as this: Brahmins, short is the life of human beings. Limited and fleeting, it has much suffering, much misery. One should wisely understand this. One should do what is wholesome, lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. So, the point here is that, of course, that even if it's 60,000 years, still life appears short. When you look back after having lived for 60,000 years, you look back, wow, what happened to all those years? They disappeared so fast, right? And let alone now, when people live maybe to 80, 90, to 100, some people, of course, it is far, far shorter than it is here. So it drives home the point that there are problems. There is a problem to be overcome. There is death, and there is all kinds of suffering in life as well. In those days, that there wasn't much suffering at all, there is certainly much more trouble in this time as it is now. So this is just an overview of the death contemplation. It gives you some, just a beautiful simile, very simple, very straight to the point, but it kind of drives home the point that death is always around the corner. You never know when it's going to happen. And then the Buddha says, whatever bhikkhus should be done by a compassionate teacher out of compassion for his disciples, seeking their welfare, that I have done for you. There are these feet of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus, do not be heedless. Do not have cause to regret it later. This is our instruction to you. So this then is perhaps one of the main reasons for doing the death contemplation, is to avoid this particular heedlessness. It reminds you of what is important in life, what actually really matters, what we need to spend our time doing. Because now is the opportunity. You don't know when that opportunity will be there again. So this is the chance, and death reminds you of that. I remember there was a man I met in Brisbane many years ago, and every day before he left his house, he left his family, he did this particular death contemplation. And as a consequence of that, he said that every day when I left my family, my wife and kids, before I left, I always made sure I left in a nice way. I never left after having argued with them. I never left with a bad kind of mood or a bad vibe, if you like, in the house. I always make sure I left in a good way, because I always realized today could be my last day. I might never see them again. So how can I die feeling a sense of regret before if I might die? What a terrible thing that would be. He was a psychologist, so maybe that was maybe he had, you know, had some more insight into these things. But anyway, I thought it was a beautiful way of how death contemplation can be used to remind you at every moment we need to be heedful and careful with how we live. Okay, so that is just a simple way of looking at the death contemplation. The next thing here is a sutta where the Buddha talks about his own life. And I particularly like the sutta. I've been reading it out a lot recently, but I still find the sutta very nice. And one of the things I always like about the Buddha, when he talks about his own life, this is the Buddha explaining to us how he lived to be an example to us, right? So there's always a very powerful teaching in there. This is what the Buddha did. And it teaches us this because we should then be following his advice and doing things in the same way. And so this is a beautiful thing. It also shows us that the Buddha was human just like we are, which makes his example so powerful. So this is how this sutta goes. This sutta is called Delicate. Because I was delicately nurtured, most delicately nurtured, extremely delicately nurtured. At my father's residence, lotus ponds were made just for my enjoyment. In one of them, blue lotuses bloomed. In another, red lotuses. In a third, white lotuses. I used no sandalwood unless it came from Kasi. And my headdress, jacket, and lower garment and upper garment were made of cloth from Kasi. By day and by night, a white canopy was held over me so that cold and heat, dust, grass, and dew would not settle on me. I had three mansions, one for the winter, one for the summer, and one for the rainy season. I spent the 4 months of the rainy season in the rainy season mansion, entertained by musicians, none of whom were male, and I did not leave the mansion. While in other people's homes, slaves, workers, and servants are given broken rice together with sour gruel for their meals, in my father's residence, they were given choice hill rice, meat, and boiled rice. So that is the Buddha talking about how he was brought up, right? And this is probably one of the closest descriptions you come in the suttas of what the Buddha's life was like before he left the household life while he was still young. And a lot of the things that you see in here, they are like the luxuries of that day, right? So you have the lotus ponds, is one classic thing in India. And you see that even today in Sri Lanka as well, they have lotus ponds. And so these are very a sign of wealth. And he says here that he used no sandalwood unless he came from Kasi. Kasi is Varanasi, Benares in India. Even today, when you go to Varanasi or to Benares, you find that they make luxury goods there. In particular, they make cloth, right? Nice cloth in Benares. And that is why also the Buddha says here that his headdress, jacket, lower garment, upper garment were made of cloth from Kasi. And if, this is like 2,500 years ago, right? And if you go to Kasi today, they still make good cloth in Kasi today, even after 2,500 years. Sometimes Benares is known as the eternal city. And when you go there, you forget this kind of slight feel of this place being quite eternal. It has kind of, nothing seems to have changed much in 2,500 years. So that's pretty, I guess, pretty eternal in the human realm. By day and night, a white canopy was held over me. Also, it says here that he had three mansions. I think the word mansion is perhaps a bit of an exaggeration. Perhaps the house would be more to the point. One for the winter, one for the summer, one for the rainy season. And then he was entertained by all these people. The last point there, of course, is quite an important one, that the slaves, the workers and servants were given good food in the house, right? So a good household is not only a wealthy household. A good household is a household where you treat people well. It's a household where there is virtue and kindness, etc. This is part of what it means to be brought up in a good household. So that is like the Buddha's background when he was younger. And the point of establishing this background, the reason why the Buddha talks about this, you may wonder why is it here. The reason is because the next thing he's going to talk about is how he then contemplated death, right? How he contemplated old age, how he contemplated illness. And the point is that it doesn't matter if you grow up in great luxury. It doesn't matter if you have everything in the human realm. Still, the reality is that the problems of human life are still pretty much exactly the same. And that, of course, is important. So it's not sometimes we think in our realm that well, you know, if I just get such and such, and I, you know, get my act together, and I get this kind of education, this kind of job, and I get a nice car or whatever, then everything would be okay. But that's missing the point. It doesn't matter what you have in the human realm. The reality is still the same. And this is what the Buddha then comes to next here. So, maybe before I go on to that, let's just do a few minutes of meditation, and then I'll come back to this in a few minutes. Let's continue again. Okay, so the Buddha has just been setting the scene for what comes next, and this is what he then thinks while he is living this household life in a fair amount of luxury. Amid such splendor and a delicate life, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to old age, not exempt from old age, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who is old overlooking his own situation. Now, I too am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who is old, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with youth was completely abandoned. So, this is what it often is like, right? You see somebody who is very old, who is kind of body is falling apart, the senses are not working anymore, the limbs, the hair is falling out, all these kind of things that happen when you get old, you can't really, not really in charge of yourself anymore. How do you feel when you see that? What is kind of your reaction when you see that? Do you feel I'm the same, or do you feel kind of slightly disgusted by it? Or what do you feel with those things when you see someone who is very, very old and falling apart? What is your reaction? And of course, if you feel disgusted, or you feel repelled by it, or humiliated, as it says here, what you're doing is that you're humiliated by yourself. Because you have the same nature, right? It's like you're humiliated with something that is already inside of you. And this is one of the important points here, is that if you are young, then old age, young youth only exists because old age exists. Old age only exists because of youth. These are two sides of the same coin. It's already in us, both youth and old age. It's already part of us. And if you are repelled by it, it means you're repelled by something that you already have as part of you. You're repelled by yourself, right? That is not a very nice thing to do, to be repelled by yourself. If you're repelled by yourself, it's almost like self-hatred almost, right? If you're repelled in this way. So the point here is that to understand that old age, in a very real sense, it's already here. It's already part of us. If you are young, if you're middle-aged, whatever it is, it's already part of you, it's already there. And in this way, you let go of this thing, he says here, you let go of the intoxication with youth, right? If you forget that you're going to be older, if you forget that you're going to die, is you get intoxicated. It's just like having a drink, and when you drink, what happens? When you drink alcohol, you start doing all kind of crazy things. Because you forget what is right, you forget what is wrong. The world gets kind of turned slightly upside down. And the intoxication with youth is a similar kind of thing. It's like things get turned upside down because you actually forget. You know it, kind of, sort of. But basically you forget that you're going to get old one day. And that is what the intoxication of youth actually means. So to get rid of that intoxication, to be able to understand what is important in life, to remember the things that really matter, then this recollection that old age, in a sense, in a very real way, is already part of you, is very powerful to correct that such a misunderstanding. So, there you are. When you see someone who is old, then it's sometimes good to think, well, that is probably me. I have been there before, I will be there again. It's already, in a real sense, part of me, as I am now. Okay, that was the first thing. The second thing that occurred to him, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to illness, not exempt from illness, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who is ill, overlooking his own situation. Now, I too am subject to illness, I'm not exempt from illness. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who is ill, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with health was completely abandoned. Right, Ajahn Brahm saying, "Doctor, doctor, something is right with me. I'm sick again," right? That's basically what this is about. So it's not something isn't wrong with you when you get ill. Something is right, because this is what to be expected when you have a physical body. Sometimes you will be ill. That's just part of nature. And sometimes when you see someone who is very ill, it can be quite the sight can be quite disturbing. Someone who is very, very sick, you go to hospital. I was in hospital recently visiting Amanda's when he was there. And some of the ill people there, they look really out of it. You know, they have cancers, have all kinds of problems. They are completely emaciated. You can look quite terrible when you are really, really ill. Or also, I saw recently they have this new cigarette packaging here in Australia, the plain packaging laws. And the pictures they have on there, I don't know if you've seen them, they're very graphic. They have a picture, one I remember was a picture of someone who had lung cancer. And there was a before and after picture of this person. I don't know if you've seen that. And before was very kind of handsome, right, good looking. And then this picture when he was just about to die, completely destroyed, right, completely emaciated, absolutely looking absolutely terrible. And it's a bit sort of, it is easy to feel repelled by that, right? But the potential for these kind of illnesses is in all of us. We may all be there one day. It is basically just part of having a physical body. This is the nature of physical bodies, that they often go in that direction. And it's quite likely that many in this room will end up in that sort of situation, perhaps all of us. So there's no basis for feeling repelled by this. Rather than feeling repelled, you have a sense of compassion. You understand the human condition. This is the human condition, right? This is what it's like to be a human being. So when you understand that, you have compassion and you feel perhaps a more sense of urgency of getting on with your spiritual practice, precisely because the human condition sometimes can be so difficult. So that is a reflection on illness. Then we have the last one here, is a reflection on death. And this is the one that I really wanted to talk about. It is the most powerful one and the one that really drives home the point here. So the uninstructed worldling, but this by the way means like the ordinary person who hasn't had any kind of spiritual teachings that are, you know, worthwhile really. Though himself subject to death, not exempt from death, feels repelled, humiliated and disgusted when he sees another who is dead, overlooking his own situation. Now, I too am subject to death, not exempt from death. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who has died, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with life was completely abandoned. So this is the most powerful of these three reflections, the reflection on death. And it is a reflection that you see in the suttas. The Buddha talks about this in many, many places. So it's an important one. And not only is it important for monastics, this is a reflection that is specifically said to be both for monastics and for lay people, both for men and women, doesn't really matter. This is a reflection for everyone. And the reason is because it is very useful to remind you, to get your priorities right. This is why it is so important. And death, of course, is the most powerful one of all these three, because when you die, that is really when your world gets turned upside down. Everything in life you have to let go of, your friends, your possessions, your family, the loved ones, everything, including your own body. It's a very all-encompassing sense of having to give things up when you die. So what is it about this reflection that is so useful? What happens when you reflect like this? Well, the first thing to remember here is that not only do we all have to die, I think that's very obvious, but very often this idea that we have to die is way at the back of our mind. It's almost as if it's not real, right? It's somewhere way off in the future somewhere. We all have this kind of basic idea, well, at least we're going to be 80 or 90 perhaps, or 75 or whatever, before we die. That's kind of the intuition we have, right? But is that really the case? Perhaps not. One of the great things about being a monk is doing all these funeral services for all kinds of people, all kinds of ages. And you realize there is no guarantee that you will be 75, 80, 90 when you die. Death can happen at any time. So because it can happen at any time, now is the time to be prepared. If you're not prepared now, the likelihood is you won't be prepared when it actually happens. Now is the only time you can be prepared. So the way to reflect then is to think that the possibilities of death are always around us. You could be leaving the retreat center today, go out driving, and you don't know, you could have a car accident. Not because of your fault, but because there are many other bad drivers out there, right? And then suddenly, that's the end of it. You could have an illness. I could have an illness in me right now. I don't know what it is. Heart disease, cancer, whatever. And suddenly, you could be gone just like that. It happens to people all the time. And that drives home. And when you think of the possibilities of death, it drives home the reality of this. It's not something which just happens to other people. No, it happens to each one of us. Right? And this is the point. When you read the paper, it looks like it happens to other people. But that's not the case. We are just like everyone else. There is always the feeling inside of us that somehow we are different. But we're not different. We are just part of humanity. So when you remember that it is always this uncertainty, it drives home the idea, the reality of death, that it can happen at any time. And this is how you contemplate death, by remembering it, by making it real, that it actually can happen. And what happens? What happens when you contemplate death? Think about that for a second. What happens? Let's say that you knew that you were going to die next week. Or let's say one way of contemplating death is to imagine yourself on your deathbed, right? You're on your deathbed. You're about to die. It could be minutes or hours. You don't know how long it's going to be. What is your reaction when that happens? You're out of here, right? This world is becoming nothing to you anymore. You're going to move on to go somewhere else. So what is your reaction going to be to the worldly things around you? If somebody comes in and they say something you don't like, are you going to start arguing with them? Are you going to start arguing with your loved ones on your deathbed? You're about to pass away. And of course the answer is no, you will never argue, you will never bother to get angry. Why? Because you're out of here. This has got nothing to do with you anymore. Just, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter what they say, it's their business. So death makes you peaceful, right? It makes you feel a sense of distance, or maybe not distance, but perspective on this world. This world is what I'm going to leave behind. It doesn't matter anymore. So you don't get angry. Nor do you have desire. If you're on your deathbed, you're not going to sit there planning all the things you're going to do in the future, right? The house you're going to build or something like that is completely irrelevant. So all the desires for this world too fade into the background. So again, it makes you peaceful. And this is the idea of the death contemplation. It gives you peace because all the angers in life, all the negativities, all the frustration, all the desires become irrelevant. It doesn't matter anymore. And when all that disappears, all you have left is a sense of peace and ease. And this is the power of this sort of contemplation when it is done in the right way. So sometimes when you want to meditate and you find it's hard to become peaceful, you find it difficult because your mind is rushing around doing all kinds of things, then try to remember that you're going to die. Remember that it's uncertain when it's going to happen. Why is there all this craving in the mind when death is just around the corner? And I also remember, sometimes when you speak to people who are old, I had a conversation with my father recently about this. And he did a lot in his life and he was successful in many ways. And I asked him, you know, what about all those things now? You know, you're a pensioner now, it's all, you know, you're 75 and, you know, life isn't going to go on for that much longer. I can't remember if I said exactly that, but it might be a bit harsh. but you know, that was kind of the implication of the conversation, right? And he said, yes, you know, all those things, they kind of seem pointless now, right? They seem like, so what? All those things. Whatever you achieved in life, now I'm going to move on. I'm going to leave it behind. All these things, they seem so important at the time, right? Relationships, education, career, possessions. They seem so, got to get out there, got to do these things. But when you get to the end of your life, And all of that, whatever you have done, has to be left behind. So what? It doesn't really matter anymore. It seems irrelevant. And it's like all of those things that you did, it wasn't wrong, but it wasn't really right either. It's like neutral. It's completely inconsequential. All those things that seem so important are now pertaining to the past, pertaining to something which is over, and you're going to move on. So what is important at that point? What is important at that point is the personality you have, the personal characteristics you have, what is in your mind, what is in your heart. That is what matters, right? So if you look back at the point of death and you see that you have developed spiritually, that you have developed your heart and mind, and you have changed yourself, that is what you can bring with you into the future. That is what goes beyond death. And that is why that is what really matters when you are about to pass away. So if you can get that into your mind now, that this is what matters, then your focus, your entire focus on life starts to shift. It doesn't mean that you don't have a job. It doesn't mean you don't have a relationship. It doesn't mean that you don't do all these other worldly things. But it means you do them differently. Instead of focusing on success in life, instead of focusing on how much possessions you have, instead of focusing on all these worldly things, you focus more on how you do these things. How am I making a career? How am I having a relationship? Not the number of relationships or the amount of money you earn, but how? Am I doing it with loving kindness? Am I doing it with compassion? Am I doing it in a virtuous way? Am I doing it with few defilements? Am I doing it with wisdom and understanding? That is what comes to matter. It's the how of life rather than the what. It's the quality rather than the quantity that comes to matter. You can see this whole shift. That whole shift happens simply because you're remembering death, right? And you become a very different person. And you start to think differently from most people in the world. Most people are just caught up. They have no perspective. You start to have perspective. So every day, remind yourself, I'm going to die. I don't know when it's going to be. And then see how that influences your mind state, how it changes your perspective, and how life becomes much more beautiful, much more powerful, much more alive as a consequence of that reflection. Okay, so that is, in brief, the contemplation of death. And when it's done well, it is not something that should lead to any kind of bad feeling, but it should lead to something very beautiful and wonderful. And then that intoxication with life disappears, right? Again, it's like being a bit like being a drunk person. You are drunk on life, so you forget the reality, you forget the bigger picture, you forget the broad perspective on things. And then the Buddha says, just to talk about bringing home the idea of intoxication towards the end here, there are bhikkhus, these three kinds of intoxication. What three? Intoxication with youth, intoxication with health, and intoxication with life. An uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with youth, engages in misconduct by body, speech and mind. With the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. An uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with health, engages in misconduct by body, speech and mind. And with the breakup of the body, they too go to a bad destination. An uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with life, engages in misconduct by body, speech and mind. With the breakup of the body after death, they go to a bad destination. So this is the consequence of this intoxication. Just like with alcohol, you end up doing misconduct by body, speech and mind because you forget your priorities, what is really important. And then you have to reap the consequences of that. And even if you don't think about rebirth, you just think about this life, you don't have a very nice life if you do all kind of bad things. Intoxicated with youth, a bhikkhu gives up the training and reverts to the lower life. Intoxicated with health, he gives up the training and reverts to the lower life. Intoxicated with life, he gives up the training and reverts to the lower life. So, if you want to be a monk, a bhikkhu for a long time, then reflect on death, reflect on old age and health. And that will keep you as a monastic, because it just shows you how short life is. Why on earth would you want to disrobe and do other things when you are already living a life that, as far as I'm concerned, is a very good life. I think it's hard to beat the monastic life in terms of opportunities to make spiritual progress and do good things in the world. This is one way of making sure that you have clarity about this. Okay, so that is the Buddha's reflections before he became a monk. And let's have another short meditation, and I'll move on to the next sutta. Okay, so the next sutta here, which is possibly the last one, is called World. And this is also a continuation of the previous theme of the ideas of the things that tend to trap us in this world contra the spiritual things in life. So, this is what the Buddha says in this case. Because these eight worldly conditions or things, eight worldly things perhaps, revolve around the world. And the world revolves around these eight worldly conditions. What eight? Gain and loss, disrepute and fame, blame and praise, pleasure and pain. These eight worldly conditions revolve around the world, and the world revolves around these eight worldly conditions. So in other words, revolves around the world. I think what is meant here is that this is what the world is about, the human world in particular. This is basically what the world usually is concerned about and what human beings are concerned about. And there often isn't much more than this. So this is a broader perspective, not just looking at sensual pleasures, but looking at all other things that people are craving for and desiring in the world. And you will see on that list, it's perhaps interesting just to note gain, just what these things are perhaps. So gain and loss basically just refers to like material possessions, right? Whatever you have, whatever you don't have, whatever you gain, whatever you lose in life. Disrepute and fame is perhaps something like a good reputation or having a bad reputation. You know, do people like you or don't they like you or whatever? What kind of reputation do you have in the community? Blame and praise, well, that's a big one. We all want to be praised, nobody wants to be blamed. There's a nice place in the sutta, I think this is in the introduction to the Brahmajala Sutta, the first sutta and the Digha Nikaya, where there are some people walking behind the monks, walking behind the Sangha of the monks. And one of these people is praising the monks, the other one is blaming them. And then the Buddha tells them, you know, how they should react when this happens. What should you do if somebody's blaming you and somebody's praising you? So what do you think? How should you react if somebody blames you for something? Or if somebody says that something is wrong with you or somebody praises you? What should you do in that situation? And what the Buddha says, you should just reflect. Is it true what they say? And or is it wrong? And if it is wrong, you can reject it, regardless of whether it's blame or praise, you can reject it. But if it's true, you can take it on board. Again, either whether it's blame or praise, you can take it on board without really getting attached to it. You don't get too proud and puffed up if somebody praises you. In the same way, you don't get depressed if somebody blames you. You take it on board, and then maybe if it's true, you try to do something about it, if it's something you can do something about. It's a very pragmatic approach to blame and praise rather than reacting to it emotionally. Because an uninstructed worldling meets gain and loss, disrepute and fame, blame and praise, pleasure and pain. An instructed noble disciple also meets with these things. What is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between an instructed noble disciple and an uninstructed worldling with regard to this? Bhante, our teachings are rooted in the Blessed One, guided by the Blessed One. Take recourse in the Blessed One. It would be good if the Blessed One would clear up the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the bhikkhus will retain it in mind. Then listen, bhikkhus, and attend closely. I will speak. Yes, Bhante, those bhikkhus replied, and the Buddha said this. Because when an uninstructed worldling meets gain, he does not reflect thus. This gain that I have met is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change. He does not understand it according to reality. When he meets with loss, same thing. When he meets with a good reputation or a bad reputation, with blame and praise, with pleasure and pain, he does not reflect thus. This pain that I have met is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change. He does not understand it according to reality. And because of that, he again obsesses his mind. Loss obsesses his mind. Fame obsesses his mind. And disrepute obsesses his mind. Blame obsesses his mind. And praise obsesses his mind. Pleasure obsesses his mind. And pain obsesses his mind. He is attracted to gain and repelled by loss. He's attracted to fame and repelled by disrepute. He's attracted to praise and repelled by blame. He's attracted to pleasure and repelled by pain. Thus involved with attraction and repulsion, he is not freed from birth, from old age and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and anguish. He is not freed from suffering, I say. So these are the worldly things, the things of the world, right? The things that most people live for are these kind of things. And the reason they live for these things is precisely because they don't understand these things as they actually are. It is impossible to always have the good side of these equations and never have the bad ones. You can't always have a gain without loss. You can't always have fame without disrepute. You can't always have praise without blame. You can't always have pleasure without pain, right? These things go together. They are just like youth and old age, life and death. They are part and parcel of life, and it can never be otherwise. And when you understand that, any moment, whatever praise you got, any moment is going to disappear, and it's going to turn into blame instead. Any moment, any pleasure you have is going to turn into pain. Once you understand that, you don't hold on to those things anymore, right? You don't grasp onto it. Nor do you grasp onto the negative things. You don't grasp onto blame, because you know that too is going to change. You don't grasp onto pain or even to loss, etc. You know that's accordance with nature, that things come and things disappear, things pass away. So this is a kind of a basic understanding of Buddhism, right? The impermanence of things. The impermanence of all these things that we are seeking in the world, always changing, always becoming otherwise. And what that leaves you, it leaves you with a mind that no longer obsesses about these things. How can you obsess with what is impermanent? Why would you obsess with things that are always changing, that are not in your control to keep or whatever? You don't obsess. And when you don't obsess, the mind becomes very even. The mind doesn't kind of go up and down. Yeah, I got praise. Ooh, I got blame. And you kind of find a sense of evenness instead. Whatever, these things are happening. Can I use it for my benefit or not? And that's really how far it goes. So you don't obsess with these things. And when you don't obsess with them, you are not repelled and attracted to one side and repelled to the other side. You have that evenness of mind. Repulsion, attraction here is just another way of talking about craving, right? There's the positive craving to what is nice and pleasant, and there is the negative craving to the things you want to get rid of. So neither repelled nor... So craving starts to become... It starts to disappear. It becomes less and less. And because of that, gradually, if you continue in this way, eventually you move towards the ending of suffering. This is part and parcel of this path. You're contemplating impermanence. You're understanding that the impermanent things in life are suffering. So you let go of this. And this is what the Buddhist path is very much about. Understanding suffering and then letting go. And then moving towards what is happiness instead. That is the uninstructed worldling. And then the exact opposite is for the instructed noble disciple. And this is how they think. This gain that I have met with is impermanent, suffering and subject to change. And he understands that gain as according to reality. Right? Your house might burn down in a bushfire. We've seen that recently in the newspapers. Your burglar might burgle your house. You just don't know what's going to happen next. When he meets with loss, he understands loss too is impermanent, subject to change. Fame is impermanent. Disrepute is impermanent. At the very least, when you die, all of the things, all the time you spent building up a good name for yourself will all be gone. Within a couple of generations, you will be completely forgotten, and nobody will know you ever existed. So what was the point in building up all that, trying to be liked by other people, etc.? blame and praise. Again, he understands that these things come and go. Pleasure and pain come and go. Because he understands that, as it really is, he is not obsessed. These things don't obsess his mind. In other words, you can sort of shrug them off. Loss does not obsess his mind, nor does fame or disrepute. Blame and praise does not obsess his mind. Pleasure and pain does not obsess his mind. Because he is not obsessed by these things, he is not attracted to gain or repelled by loss. Attracted to fame or repelled by disrepute. He's not attracted to praise or repelled by blame. Not attracted to pleasure or repelled by pain. Having thus discarded attraction and repulsion, having discarded craving, right, is what it means. He is freed from birth, from old age and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and anguish. He is freed from suffering, I say. This, Bhikkhus, is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between an instructed, noble disciple and an uninstructed worldling. So all these things in the world, when you start to see them more clearly, they have less of a grasp on your mind. They hold on to you less, and you can let go of them a little bit. Again, this doesn't mean, sometimes people misunderstand this and they think that you should just try to reject all these things out of hand because it says so in the suttas. But you can't do that. That's the wrong way of doing it. Because you cannot just reject things out of hand. What you have to do is to gradually practice. And as you gradually practice and you reflect on these things, it is a natural consequence that these things fade into the background. When it happens naturally, then it's quite easy. If you try to force these things to happen, it becomes painful and difficult. So allow it to happen naturally. Reflect on these things and it will go in the right direction. So, again, the reason why I have mentioned this here again is that when you can see here that all of these things are about reducing craving, right? And part of the reduction of craving is also the reduction of anger and irritation and obsessions of the mind and all these kind of things. So all of this is to help you reduce the defilements of the mind. The mind becomes more even. The mind instead, you fortify it with metta, with compassion, with all these other things instead. And you're turning yourself around. And you're starting to see the world in a new way. This is what is happening here. And then your meditation starts to become more powerful. It starts to take off. Because your whole attitude is changing. So this is what this is about. There you are. So this is, of course, this is for fairly... You know, some people when they read this, they think, gee, this is not what I came to Buddhism for. And fair enough. But remember that this is not something that you should use to throw everything out of it. It's just something to reflect on, right? Does it make sense or not? And then you take away the things that you can use, and you don't take away those things that you find too hard. You put them aside for the time being, and you reflect on them perhaps, and then maybe sometime in the future, you might bring them up again to see if now perhaps they make sense. So don't force yourself to do things that basically you think is wrong. There's no point in that sort of thing at all. Okay, then I'm going to read out the very last sutta here called the Gotamaka Sutta. And this is the Buddha trying to arouse the Sangha, arouse the people, arouse the monks and the bhikkhunis to practice, right? And this is what he says. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vesali, at the Gotamaka shrine. There the Blessed One addressed the monks. Monks, I teach the Dhamma through direct knowledge, not without direct knowledge. In other words, I know what I'm talking about, right? I'm not just saying stuff. I teach the Dhamma with a basis, not without basis. Again, I know what I'm talking about. I have seen these things for myself. This is not empty prattle. This is important stuff. I teach the Dhamma that is wonderful, perhaps convincing or reliable, not one that is not. It is wonderful because it works. It is wonderful because if you follow the advice of the Buddha, it gives rise to the same results. One of the great teachings of the Buddha is when he says that the wonders of the world, the miracles of the world, are not the kind of the weird things you sometimes read about, you know, reading someone else's mind or flying through the air or walking on the water, etc. This is not the miracle in Buddhism. The real wonder in Buddhism, says the Buddha, is the fact that when you teach someone, when the Buddha teaches somebody, they are able to achieve the same results as the Buddha. That is the wonder. Right? It's quite fascinating, but this is the wonder. And this is why the Dhamma is so wonderful. Because when you follow the same path, you will achieve the same results as the Buddha achieved 2,500 years ago. It's powerful stuff. Then he says, since I teach the Dhamma through direct knowledge, in other words, because this is true, not without direct knowledge, that teach the Dhamma with a basis, I know that this works, not without a basis. It's a teach the Dhamma that is wonderful, that actually works for anyone when they practice it, not one that is not. My teaching should be acted upon. My instruction should be acted upon. It is enough for you to rejoice, enough for you to be elated, enough for you to be joyful. The Blessed One is perfectly awakened. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good path. Okay, so that's what the Buddha says to inspire us, to remind ourselves that this actually works. It is truly worthwhile. It is based, it is for our own happiness and for the happiness of everyone else that we practice these wonderful teachings of the Buddha. And that is to kind of get us on the right track there towards the very end. Okay.